Good morning, church.
Good morning.
How are you all this morning? My name is Pastor Ebony. For those who may not know who I am and who are visiting, welcome. Thank you for being here with us. So this morning I'm preaching on 1 Kings. It's a really hard text to preach on. So since I've been at CAN, one of my disciplines has been to follow the lectionary. And so I stick to that, regardless what the text is. I stick to that, but I thank God for inspiration. Who led me through this really hard time of trying to figure out what I was going to say about Kings and Solomon. Aha, thank you. So, over the last year, you must be wondering why I have arranged the altar like this. There's purpose in my madness, I promise. Over the last year, I've given a lot of attention to the rituals that sustain my well-being and my spirituality. While I have struggled a bit in thinking about what those rituals would consist of, this past Easter, I decided that one of the rituals that I would start is watering and taking care of plants, and gifting those plants as well. Amidst all of the pain and death in the world, I wanted to be a part of something that signified and that gave life. So I went to Home Depot the day before Easter and bought a few plants that I then gave to my children. I gave them other stuff, and so when I gave them the plants, they didn't even realize what I was doing. So next time, give them the sentimental stuff first and then give the other stuff on top of that afterwards. But peace lilies were my first gift, representing the continuation of life.
Came more about caring for the plants amidst the death and pain that we were experiencing. I began to water to pour out libations every time I read about the passing of someone in our community. I didn't necessarily need to know who they were. I didn't need to know their name. They could be family members, friends, co-workers, disconnected, and somehow just people who had existed. I didn't need to know them for their lives, their names, the whole meaning to me. So rather than create a hashtag, I poured, and when the weather changed, and I planted our vegetable garden, I began to pour libations some more. Just a few weeks ago, many of us heard and learned about the passing of Dr. King in the Canada. Dr. Cannon was the first African-American woman ordained by the Presbyterian Church and one of the founders of womanist theology. I had an opportunity to meet Dr. Cannon this past April, just a few days after I bought the plants. Guys, oh wow. I just realized that. I had an opportunity to meet Dr. Cannon a few days after that I bought the plant at an Iowa Center for Women's Leadership gathering this past April. And I didn't know her, but I appreciated her radical hospitality and the way that she held space for all of those who were there. While I had only just begun to learn about her work and her scholarship, I so appreciated the sacrifices that she made as a Black woman theologian. And to stay, I stand on the shoulders of women like her who have paved the way for people like me to come up behind.
So, Dr. Katie Cannon, I stand on her shoulders, in the shoulders of people like Dr. Cannon, whether they are living in debt or dead, who paved the way for women like me. Aretha Franklin is another who paved the way, and another who just passed a week right after Dr. Katie Cannon. Her music has inspired many through the years, and her song Respect, that I distinctly remember performing at Summerfest in Milwaukee. And I was thinking about calling my sister, asking her if she also remembered performing the song, but I decided not to. Regardless, Respect is almost an anthem for women everywhere, at least in America, to be treated with dignity and honor in our relationships. So this morning, I want to bring my ritual into this place today. Here I have a purple plant. There's a reason why it's purple. To pour out libation for both Dr. Cannon and Aretha Franklin. Purple because this is the womanist way, as in the words of Alice Walker, womanism is to feminism as purple is to lavender. So, for Dr. Katie Cannon, for Miss Aretha Franklin, Ashe. Ashe. This is an ancient African tradition, really, really ancient, that has a lot of significance about honoring deity, ancestors, and life in the environment. Today, I want to honor these ancestors who've become ancestors. There's a reason I invoke their particular names today. Even though Kofi Annan passed yesterday and is really, really important, I invoke Dr. Katie Cannon and Aretha Franklin's name today, not just because they died, though it is a part of it. The other piece is that Dr. Katie Cannon and Miss Aretha represent women who have pushed against seemingly insurmountable barriers to be where they were, both because they were Black, but also because they were women. It is not easy as Black women to live out the calling of God on our lives because of the cultural stereotypes against women, stereotypes that in this country are intertwined with racism and white supremacy, but that has ancient roots in patriarchy that is thousands of years deep. I want us to understand that this morning, patriarchy is not new to the American soil. This is ancient, thousands of years. And so when we begin to talk about patriarchy here and we don't connect it to our ancient history, we're missing a big piece of the equation. Today, I want to address this patriarchy, but first I want to share this poem that I wrote a few days ago that I think will help set up the framework for where we're going today. It is called Setting Eve Free. Sister girl, how they've had your name locked up for years. Said it was you who ate the apple, was led astray by your lust, bringing down the integrity of the world with your seductive touches and your questioning, wandering eyes. They said it was you who've been entrapping men, bending and folding them in the grip of your thighs, tantalizing them with the fullness of your breast, leading them to hell with the way the sun radiates off of your coily black hair, whether it is locked, picked out, or flowing down your back. So they told you to shut up, put up, dial it back, stay in your place, be seen and not heard, and accept your plight as ordained by God for your sin. And we believe them. We let them drag your name through dung itself. We distance ourselves from you, disassociated ourselves from the most intimate pieces of ourselves so that we would not succumb to the Jezebel, Sapphire, Delilah stereotype. But we've gotten older and a bit wiser. We've had children of our own now, the stretch marks in places we didn't even know were possible. The graying of our hair while we still trying to remain at that youthful vigor of days long ago. The way our thighs jiggle now, no matter how thin we are. We've learned some things living in our bodies, being in touch with our full selves. We found out they lied. Told the biggest story of all. And us all believing it was you. You who destroyed the world, who broke up homes, impregnated yourself, knocked yourself unconscious, pushed yourself down the flight of stairs, played the whore, brought the misfortune upon yourself because of the way you dress, the way your hips move too much, the color of your lips, because of where you were, because of who you were with. Now we know the story is only beginning to unfold. The truth, your truth, was always there, in plain sight, hidden in between the folds of the pages, though it took a trained eye to see, because we've internalized the lie for so long, we needed help to be brought back to you. Brought back to our truth. The truth we bear as women, young and old, rich and poor, black and white and Latinx and queer and all of us. To see our stories, our identities so intricately wrapped together. Though patriarchy has damaged us, forced us to choose sides, none of us are going free till we all get free. None of us are going free till Eve. Sister girl, mother, daughter, friend, from whom all things come forth, who birthed the world though the world despises her so. Till Eve rises up out of the pages, reclaims her narrative, tells the story that is just beginning to unfold, to be silent no more, to no longer be either a passive or active participant in our destruction. The whole world is at stake. The whole creation groans with groanings that cannot even be uttered for our liberation. Eve, sister girl, we stand with you. We got you. We believe in you just as much as we believe in ourselves, in our stories, held in our bodies, just anxious to come out. The poem I read to you, I crafted this week. But the reality is, I've been working for some time as a theologian to get Eve free from what I found was a trap, a clever ruse to distract us from hearing the full story. I'm not sure when the discomfort with her story started. Perhaps at some level, I've always been uncomfortable with this rendering of truth. Perhaps that is why I'm so extremely terrified of snakes, and my husband can attest to this. For as long as I can remember, I've just been so deathly afraid of them. I didn't even write the word snake in my manuscript, lest I accidentally click on it and up pop this image. It's happened before, and I had to go next door and ask my neighbor to come and get the image off my computer. I'm that afraid. But I blame them for tempting the women, for bringing the sin into the world. And I internalize this truth because the Bible told me so. The Bible told me that Eve was to blame for the labor pains and the periods. But it also told me that women's bodies were to blame for the violence that we reaped upon ourselves, for men losing their ever-loving minds when it came to how we looked and how we dressed. Because of these bodies, we were often ceremoniously unclean. Because of these bodies, we weren't qualified as priests in the Old Testament or pastors in the New. Because of these bodies and the sins that these bodies brought, the best that we could do was to submit to the authority of our husbands, be quiet in the church, cover ourselves, and walk in perpetual penance all of our days, lest in our waywardness we stumble or cause the good Christian men around us to stumble. How many women have ever been told that? Tell the truth. Tell the truth. Shame the devil. Tell the truth. One example of where you see this ideology play out in the scriptures is in the book of Proverbs. There are many places, but I want to talk about Proverbs. Ascribed to be the writing of King Solomon, Proverbs is counted as one of the five books of wisdom in the Old Testament. While some of the pieces are really encouraging, like trust in the Lord with all your heart, lean not on your own understanding, I love that scripture. I still remember it. There are random places that chastise women who lead men astray. Proverbs chapter 5 is just in one of those places in the text where this occurs. Hear the following lines from chapter 5. My son, pay attention to my wisdom. Listen carefully to my wise counsel. Then you will show discernment and your lips will express what you've learned. For the lips of an immoral woman are as sweet as honey and her mouth is smoother than oil. But in the end, she is bitter as poison, as dangerous as a double-edged sword. Her feet go down to death. Her steps lead straight to the grave, for she cares nothing about the path of life. She staggers down a crooked trail and doesn't realize it. Stay away from this woman. Don't go near the door of her house. If you do, you will lose your honor, and you will lose to merciless people all you have achieved. Strangers will consume your wealth, and someone else will enjoy the fruit of your labor. Now, does that sound like an encouraging passage? It's unsettling to me, and I know it has to be for other women and probably men as well who love women. Yet, I have at times dismissed them because they were accredited to King Solomon. When we come to today's passage, we see that this Solomon has this amazing dream, so to say, where God asks him to make a wish, kind of like a genie in a bottle kind of thing. And Solomon, being the man that he is, you see this really well-designed prayer where he asks God not for wealth, but for wisdom so that he can discern between good and evil and govern God's people. Just remember that phrase, discern between good and evil. We're going to come back to that. This is how the text reads at first glance. But as we dig into the text and the surrounding texts and narratives, we will see that there is more to the story. if we look, take a look at chapter 2, the verses in between the lectionary passages today, and I love the lectionary, but I wonder why those who wrote it decided to leave this big chunk of chapter 2 out. You know where I'm going. We will see that Solomon, in these verses, he makes a lot of moves to consolidate this empire that God gives him, right? By killing off the competition, he gets rid of people who were his father's enemies, not to mention the enemies that he made himself along the way. Three times in this passage, there is mention of this kingdom that was his father's that is now firmly established in Solomon's hands. And there is also mentioned that this kingdom will endure forever. Where have we heard this language before? Rome's eternal city, about the kingdom enduring forever. Solomon's quest for wisdom, then, cannot be understood apart from this nation-building idea and the efforts that are also made known in 1 Kings 4 through 11. In isolation, Solomon's desire for wisdom appears innocent enough. I mean, I would pray for wisdom, too. I need it to raise my kids. It's even a righteous request. But in the context of this entire story, it is evident that Solomon's request is nothing more than nation building in an attempt to co-opt God into that mess. Like, if you hear the verses, God is like, I will grant you your request. God, you're God. You get to do whatever you want to do. You don't have to subject yourself to Solomon or to David or to any of the biblical writers. You're God. You get to be free. But Solomon co-opts God. And so now God is bound just as much as women are. Solomon's moves, though, are not unique. And so I don't want us going here blaming the Bible, because they are not unique. Solomon is actually wise, to use that word, in the way that he's going about things. They are pretty commonplace in the way that empires build themselves up and grasp for power. In fact, even the quest for wisdom is also a very imperialistic way of doing things and a way of being. As in this search for wisdom or search for rational, empirical thought, objective truth, is also about rationalizing our unholy quest to build these earthly kingdoms at the expense of the people. It is extractive and it is oppressive, because with their truth, there is now justification to steal people's lands, colonize bodies, and make life a living hell for anyone who gets in the empire's way. That also sounds familiar, right? Into the context of this own land. To make matters even worse for Solomon, his desire to build the temple and create this controlled static religion is an attempt to usurp the power and authority of God. Now Solomon gets to be the prophet, the priest, and the king. Now Solomon, as you see in the rest of the verses of chapter 3, now he gets to be the judge, the jury, and the executioner. The people and God herself are Solomon's servants. And because God ordained it, there is nothing no one can do about it. But this is not God ordained. This is nationalistic propaganda. God is not affirming the existence of this kingdom. She is judging it. And the people of Israel, after experiencing the consequences of the Davidic Solomonic rule, is judging it too. As captives in Babylon, reflecting back on their experience through the centuries, they start to tell a different story. A story that holds the empire that brought the wrath of God down upon their heads, a radically different story. And it goes like this. In the beginning, when God created the heavens and the earth was a formless void and darkness covered the face of the deep, while a wind from God swept over the face of the waters. Then God said, let there be light. And there was light. And God saw that the light was good, and God separated the light from the darkness. God called the light day, and the darkness he called night. And there was evening, and there was morning, the first day. Y'all recognize that story, right? Recognize it because it's the first few verses of the book of Genesis. Yes, while captives in Babylon, the Israelites start to pen the book of Genesis to help explain their experience in captivity and to make sense of how they got there. interpreting their reality in the light of the exile. They want a deeper understanding of all that has led up to these moments in captivity. Asking the question that many of us ask when we find ourselves either somewhere we did not expect to be or where we did not want to be. How did we get here? What happened to us? The Israelites, who at this time are elite privileged men, as the poor and infirm are left behind in Jerusalem, they begin to put the pieces of this narrative together, borrowing some from the Babylonians' own sacred text, as well as their own history, as well as probably other creation stories. They weave together the story of how it all happened. They share with us their understanding of creation, including the earth, the land, the flora, the fauna, and God's intentional design in creating men and women. And it starts off really beautiful. They explain this union that once existed between humanity and God, as well as humanity's relation with humanity's own self, the earth, and one another. Then in chapter 3, something goes wrong, and apparently it is all downhill from there. All because Eve ate from the tree of knowledge between good and evil. Remember I said we're going to use that phrase again? And she cajoled her husband into joining in the fun, something that God forbid them to do. However, when we consider our text today and understand that this book was written prior, that Solomon and Kings is actually the first book that was written, because writing is not older than 1500 BC, so Genesis could not have come first. It was actually 1 Kings and Solomon, because writing is a tool of the empire. So I digress, but just to situate you guys so that you're all up to speed where I am. when we understand that Samuel and 1 Kings are written to before all the other texts, and that the authors of Genesis clearly have Solomon's empire in mind as they're penning this text, using the same words and the same phrases that are in Kings, we will see that the culprit is not Eve at all. Instead, Eve is a metaphor representing an entire people who have turned their backs away from God by pursuing development instead of trusting in what God provides. For millions of years of human existence, this people, all people, were hunters and gatherers and relied on the sustenance that God either provided out of the bush or from the ground. And we know that. We've talked about that here. So that's not new. However, when the shifts in agriculture, development, and eventually empire begins to be commonplace, the dynamics of human relationships change. All of a sudden, oppression, exploitation, and slavery are introduced into the world. Patriarchy becomes not only a reality, but a necessity. In the human heart that was once content in the simplicity of relationships with one another and with God turns away. The unfortunate reality for us today is that while the authors of Genesis make an honest attempt, and I really do believe that they're being sincere, to explain the situation, they themselves cannot back away from the already existing cultural stereotype against women. This is a stereotype that is bigger than the writers of the biblical text, and it is as pervasive as anywhere patriarchy exists. The biblical writers then take what exists to communicate to Israel's elite, privileged men the gravity of their sin. Throughout the text, we see women's bodies, sexuality, and our very essence condemned for leading men astray, not just in Genesis, but throughout the whole Old Testament. In fact, it was women who supposedly led Solomon's heart away from God, and not the fact that he was obsessed with power, wealth, and prestige. No one told him to marry 1,000 wives and concubines. Who does that? No one. Like, why? Like, come on, common sense. But his lust for power by any means compelled him to do that. You don't do that unless you're trying to make alliances with all these other foreign kings and get into their good graces and get their resources. That's why Solomon did that. They didn't lead him away from God. He led himself away from God. I am. Our bodies are also the basis from which these authors chastise Israel. Ideas about the unfaithfulness, the promiscuity, the unchaste behavior of women permeate the Old Testament scriptures. The prophets pricking up on the Hebrews' men's already existent fear of sexuality and bodily functions use it to their advantage. Get this. The prophets picked up on what already existed. They're wise, but it doesn't make it right. In her book, Badder Loved, womanist Renita Weems explains as well. Both the female body and female sexuality proved to be ideal vehicles for connotating the shame and humiliation that resulted from Israel's actions and for tapping into the enormous passion and sentimentally tied up with God's claim on Israel. The stereotypical belief that the female body and female sexuality were somehow dangerous, disgusting, threatening, and needing to be controlled played well into the prophet's efforts to push their audience to perceive both the abnormality of their behavior and the perils that lay ahead should they continue on their course. It should come as no surprise, therefore, that through the prophet's writings, this metaphor is used almost exclusively to personify Israel negatively and to paint its history with God as volatile. Did you get that? So, penning Genesis, the authors have this stereotype in mind. Even in their intent to expose the empire and rebuke Solomon for his desire to discern between good and evil, they still err by scapegoating Eve with the same desire to discern between good and evil, finding it easier to use the same metaphor that is found in the prophets about women's bodies than to explicitly call out patriarchy's role in empire building. Unfortunately, we can't get back to a simpler time where we lived off the land, where we foraged, where we just, you know, lived off of what God provided, in our balanced relationships between God, self, and the other, and where power and balance didn't exist in our relationships. Turning away from Eden, where when the angels closed that door, is to turn away from that. We can't go back there no matter how much we try, because we can't unknow patriarchy. We can't unknow white supremacy and racism and genocide and land theft. Like, our bodies know that now. We can't unknow it. But we can turn away from these things and create a new reality which will take intentional, concentrated, daily practice, including getting enough sleep, Ebony. Eliminating sugar, dairy, and gluten from our diets because they will give you heartburn, Ebony. And y'all too. Intentional movement, meditation, prayer, being our creative selves, and being in community with one another, advocating, resisting, calling out the things that are evil and demonic. Like, it takes concentrated daily efforts in doing that. As the Apostle Paul suggests, our commitment to Christ must be exercised daily through the rituals that we adopt to sustain ourselves. Exhibit A. But those rituals must also involve the body, so that the division that has occurred between our spirits and embodies as a result of this dualistic Western thought, which is an extension of empire, is healed. We are so separated from our bodies. The more and more we go after this Western thinking of what is right and wrong, black and white, this binary way of thinking, we separate ourselves from these bodies that God has made us. We have to come back into our bodies intentionally through these practices. And as we give birth to liberation in these ways, we're giving birth to this. Y'all notice all my metaphors are about women and birth and life, not fighting in war. We got to do that too. We got to change the metaphors. We will immediately recognize that freedom will not, it cannot come on the backs of women, whether they are cisgendered or transgendered. We cannot build movements, theologies, frameworks, political ideologies that demonize women, that allow for the physical or sexual abuse of women, the alienation of women, or the silencing of women in the name of progress or political expediency. Frameworks that don't include women, and especially women of color, especially women of color, especially women of color, and indigenous women and trans women need to be challenged. Strategies that exist off the backs of women need to be either revised or abandoned, meaning if we're not in your boardrooms, if we're not writing the text, if we're not in your seminaries, You got to do a different thing. The same is true for other marginalized identities. As the old organizing adage goes, anything about us, without us, is not for us. We have to seriously wrest ourselves from the thinking of Eve ruining the world and from the ideologies that suggest there is evil bound up in our bodies. This has never been true. We are not to blame for the sin that we have bore upon our bodies. We are not to blame for Solomon's wives leading the nation of Israel astray and into apostasy. And Eve is not to blame for bringing sin into the world. Let's call a spade, patriarchy is. Which means that we all get to go free, all of us. Not just the women, the men. We all get to go free. And we can hold Solomon accountable for the being the power-hungry, horny, greedy king that he is. The best news of all is that God gets to go free. God is no longer has to be bound to this idea that she justifies the existence of this mess. God can at last stand in total opposition of it, rather than jostling back and forth between justifying oppression in some instances and calling it out in others. Which is good news for us because it means that this ancient God that we worship, that is millions of years old, is always on the side of women. She's always on the side of the poor, the marginalized, the infirm, and in all the ways that we embody these intersecting identities. This God that we serve, she is a fierce advocate for those who are dispossessed and those who bear the marks of empire upon our bodies, because we all have them. This God, through Jesus Christ, delivers those who've been held hostage by empire, freeing them from mass incarceration, trauma inflicted on their bodies, and even state execution itself. And this God empowers each of us with the ability to continually press for liberation until she comes and restores the balance that once sustained the world. We are free. We are completely and totally and unequivocally free. We sung about it this morning. We have testified about it this morning. And our bodies, I know y'all feel different this morning, right? Y'all feel different. I feel different. When I realized this week, I was like, baby, my husband, guess what? Because I felt so free, like Eve did not get us into this. Oh my gosh, this is the good news I've been looking for. I feel free. So we're going to celebrate that freedom. I invite you to stand up. So I have been studying womanist theology, and womanism is not just about women preaching. It's about women doing a new thing. So let's stand up. Let's all stand up. Isaac is going to put on a song. I thank my children for this because they're always singing it. Give credit to the babes. We're going to move a little bit. We're not going to be Presbyterian about it. We're going to be Pentecostal about it. Invoke your Ashe. Move just a little bit. If you're a little shy, just move back and forth. That's okay. If you feel really uncomfortable, you can close your eyes. We're going to just do it for a few minutes. And then it'll be over as quickly as it started. But if we are going to be free, we have to embody freedom. We don't just intellectualize it, because then we're doing this Western thing again. We have to move it through our bodies. So this morning, we're going to move.
My voice.
When I'm allowed to say what I want.
So being you, that's how you're liberated. That's how you're free.
Liberation starts within yourself.
To be truly liberated, you are accepted.
Education.
Liberate myself so that I can.
You guys can start moving.
You just have to do what makes you.
Total freedom. We all need a little bit more of it, you know?
Love yourself and all the things around you.
There's a lot of power in liberation.
Loosen up a little bit. Don't be so stiff.
This is for the girls that don't need no makeup when they wake up.